Hello, and welcome to a special interview episode of the 404 Media Podcast, where we bring you unparalleled access to hidden worlds, both online and IRL. 404 Media is a journalist-founded company and needs your support. To subscribe, go to 404media.co. As well as bonus content every single week, subscribers also get access to additional episodes where we respond to their best comments. Gain access to that content at 404media.co. I'm your host, Joseph. And it's just me today, as this is the first episode of our new and very much experimental interview series. Every so often, we're going to sit down with people who we think you'll genuinely want to hear from. This is not replacing the normal weekly podcast. Rather, we'll do one when something interesting or someone interesting comes up. Subscribers, as usual, get early access, and then it'll go out onto the main feed. Today, my guest is Byron Tao, author of Means of Control, How the Hidden Alliance of Tech and Government is Creating a New American Surveillance State. Byron, thank you so much for coming onto the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, no problem. Some context for listeners. I mean, listeners and readers may be familiar with my work on how government agencies buy location data from apps. You know, I've done the military, some law enforcement agencies, all that sort of thing. Well, I only started doing that because it was Byron who first exposed the sale of location data to DHS in a Wall Street Journal article a few years ago at this point. So that's, of course, why I wanted to bring Byron on. But his new book expands on that reporting massively. And it puts not only that data collection, but a ton of other post-Snowden surveillance into a context I hadn't really thought about before, like a ton of stuff I didn't know. So if you're at all interested, I do wholly recommend you go and you get a copy and you read it. But Byron, the book starts with a dinner party. I know you can't go into super detail about maybe who was there or what exactly was going on in order to protect your sources, but could you just build that scene for us as much as you can? And I guess most importantly, why did you open them with that and why is this dinner important?
Yeah, so essentially, I think this was sometime in 2018. I'm listening to someone talk at a party about mobile phone data and how the Pentagon or Pentagon-linked contractors were taking advantage of this. And this just sort of floored me, right? Because this was not a vector that I had previously considered for surveillance. I mean, I think we all know that the police need to go get a warrant to get your cell movement data, or they need to get a wiretap order to listen in on your phone calls. We have some sense that there are these privacy protections built into various technologies that we use. But this person was describing a world in which Apple and Google and the nation's largest advertising firms and these anonymous companies had built this entire ecosystem where data was collected off of mobile devices. I was given a pseudonymized ID, and it was available for sale in these very opaque marketplaces. And one of the buyers of this data was the Department of Defense or Department of Defense-linked contractors. And that really floored me and started this reporting journey that would ultimately take more than 5 years of my life and culminated first in a story I published in the Wall Street Journal in early 2020. And I kept going. During the height of the pandemic, I was stuck at home. I was bored. I was obsessed with this topic still. And I just kept reporting on it until I had this book. And, you know, it's a story that I think speaks to the ways in which technology can be inadvertently or unintentionally designed in ways that things that you wouldn't expect happen, right? So I don't think most of these advertising companies or the tech giants intended to create a government surveillance system, but because of the way they architected, their advertising systems and their technology, they had essentially created a backdoor. And government contractors were not eager to talk about that backdoor because they had started to find the data useful.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, just in case this isn't clear to listeners, you do mention some of the big companies there. You know, there are the Facebooks and the Googles, obviously. And then there's a ton of these smaller companies that your book goes into in detail. I kind of just want to clarify for listeners that, yes, Facebook and Google obviously gather a lot of data, but they're not out there literally selling it. Like, you can't just go and give Google however X amount to just download a CSV of location data. the book primarily is talking about these much smaller players, right, who do that. Is that fair?
That's exactly right. Most of the companies in this ecosystem that I write about in this book are entities that most people have never heard of. And they, in general, have no consumer-facing relationship, right? Facebook, Google, Apple, they have a one-to-one relationship with the consumer, and the consumer may expect that Facebook gets some information about you when you sign up, that Google knows where you are when you use Maps. But what people don't realize is that every time they download an ad-supported app load a website with open ad space, that there are all these companies lurking in the background that are in a position to collect location data, and some of them broker it, and some of them broker it to government contractors. And so this shadowy world of brokers and advertisers that are not public facing companies is what I really focus on in the book.
Yes, absolutely. And one of those companies is Babble Street, but just to ask the most important question at the top, because I've covered this company a bunch, you've obviously covered them as well. Is it Babble Street or is it Babel Street? Like, which one is it?
I think it's Babble Street. That's generally how people that I've talked to who are familiar with the company pronounce it.
Sure.
I think that's how most Americans pronounce, like, the Tower of Babel in the Bible.
Yes.
And I think that's what they're going for.
Yeah, I think I'm at a disadvantage in that I'm coming in as a British person, and also I'm just really bad at pronouncing stuff. So, you know, that's a constant theme on this podcast, and we're not going to give that up. But you describe how the company started and then how it grew. And then I think eventually you get to, like, this beef that it had with Twitter, if I'm remembering correctly. Could you just briefly explain how it started and how and why it grew?
Sure. So Babble was formed by two former intelligence officers. The proto-Babble version of the company did a lot of, like, Arabic names and transliteration stuff, and they were purchased by a well-known data broker called Axiom. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, these two people who founded the company went over to Axiom for a little bit, and then they essentially bought the IP back. So one of the co-founders, Jeff Chapman, buys some of the IP back from Axiom and founds a second company, Babble Street. And originally it sprung up to to monitor social conversations. So they were looking at social media feeds, and they had built a pretty clever way of doing sort of transliteration on the fly. Languages were their specialty, right? Because at the time, there was a big war on terror focus, and the ability to look at social media across multiple languages and look for keywords in those languages was very important. So Babble believed it could distinguish itself from others in the social space by building in this quick transliteration capability. But ultimately, as the company matured, they would add lots and lots and lots of data sources beyond social data, including the location data and the advertising data we're talking about, but also some dark web stuff and some, you know, stuff like web forums and all sorts of other data sources. And they would grow to become one of the bigger open source intelligence tools or platforms, if you will, for a while. And they would get very in with law enforcement and the military and the special forces community.
Yeah. Yeah. I've reported on a bunch of contracts from them. And as you say, with the translation stuff, you'll typically get a bunch of FOIA records back. And there may be some ad tech or some location data stuff in there, which, as you say, they did a little bit later. But a lot of them are simply, we want to have a feed of Arabic social posts, which are then translated into English or whatever. And that makes complete sense now and puts into context where they came from and how they grew. But what was this issue with Twitter that came up? Like, they were accessing Twitter data and Twitter didn't like that. Like, what happened there exactly?
Sure. So Twitter has gone back and forth over the years over whether to license data to government-linked entities. And initially, they were fairly open with it, right? Because they believe that, well, Twitter is actually public. So what sort of privacy expectation does the average Twitter user have when you can just go to twitter.com/their username and read all their tweets? Mm-hmm. But around 2014, when it was revealed that you know, lots of local police departments were monitoring the Twitter feeds of activists who were participating in the racial justice protests. It became a little bit more controversial to sell to governments. And so Twitter started clamping down on the licensing of its data to government entities and put very specific restrictions on what you can and cannot do with their data. So they would allow certain government use cases. They wouldn't allow anything to do with protests or monitoring people for domestic law enforcement. They didn't like sort of persistent monitoring, so looking at, you know, one username over time. But they did let the military and military contractors do stuff like force protection. So if a government there was a government facility abroad, they could maybe pull a small geographic sampling of tweets around their facility or around their forward deployed unit. And Twitter worked very hard with companies like Dataminr to build tools that would comply with their vision of how they should license data. Babel Street, however, did not want to necessarily follow the rules. At least that's what my sources say. And Twitter repeatedly caught them violating the terms of service for the feed or scraping their data. And so Twitter essentially cut them off, and they devised a workaround where they were trying to access Twitter's more limited public API by creating a number of dummy accounts. Unfortunately for them, their employees all used their Babel Street emails to create these dummy accounts, which made pretty easy for Twitter to figure out that this was a company that was trying to access the public API repeatedly for the purposes of trying to scrape it or to get around the limitations. And so, you know, this is something of an OPSEC lapse for a group of former military and intelligence officers, but they were caught and cut off again.
Yes. You mentioned that, you know, this is what your sources tell you, obviously. And on that, I mean, not even so much specifically on this company or really any other, but you've been investigating this space and this industry for a long time. I've been doing the same. I know how hard it is to get people inside these companies to talk, you know, including current and former. I've had some success. You've taken it a lot further. How did you build up sources in this industry and in this space?
It's a good question. And by the way, I want to say I've built a lot of my reporting on your reporting. So in many ways, it was a team effort.
Even though we work for different outlets and stuff, indeed. You know, we're all doing the same thing, basically. Yeah.
Truth is important, right? And, yeah. And that's how I see a lot of this. And, you know, a lot of these stories I wouldn't have been able to do if it wasn't for things that you and other reporters who are interested in this topic did as well.
Sure.
It's a hard world to penetrate, but ultimately, a lot of these programs are technically unclassified. And essentially, if you send enough LinkedIn messages or make enough cold calls or reach out to enough people, you can get some sense as to what is happening inside these companies. Other ways to report the story are, of course, contract records and the Freedom of Information Act. I did file a lawsuit at some point against the government and got some stuff back related to these programs. There were some interesting court documents involving employment fights and other things where details sometimes spilled out into the public record there. And talking to people inside government as well, right? Because the contractors and the program managers and the lawyers inside government often also know about these tools and programs. And so it was just a matter of being diligent and patient and playing the long game to try to understand how this world worked and what I could learn from the outside.
Yeah, totally. That makes sense. I think, kind of obviously, the last major surveillance story that most people know is obviously like the Snowden revelations. Of course, there's been a ton since then, but that was obviously explosive, right? 2013, it completely shifted the conversation around privacy, around surveillance, around legislation around that. You know, more and more websites turned on HTTPS. We had the massive proliferation of end-to-end encryption apps, including Signal and Wicker and Wire and any other of the number of them that came after. The way I read the book was that, especially in reaction to Snowden and that increased sort of clampdown on that surveillance when, you know, a light was shone on it, it seems that there is also this other massive surveillance story that just isn't necessarily getting the same amount of attention, in part because it's absolutely so complicated. It's spread across an industry rather than like a single NSA program or a single DoD program, although you do mention some of those in the book. I guess, can you just tell listeners, like, was that the intention here? You were trying to show this as like the post-Snowden surveillance apparatus? Like, am I missing the mark there? Or
no, I think that's essentially right. I mean, I think Snowden anchors the story in a way because it is a moment in which the global public turned to a wonky and previously boring topic, which is, you know, lawful intercept and surveillance, and really got a deep look inside of how countries, primarily the United States and its allies and Great Britain and other Five Eyes countries, were doing surveillance. And then, of course, things moved on, right? There were major changes to the architecture of the internet. There were reforms to the surveillance programs themselves, and people sort of went on with their lives. But of course, governments never lost interest in acquiring data about the global population, and the ways in which the governments are acquiring data changed a bit after Snowden, right? I'm not saying there's a direct line between Snowden and the rise of encryption and ad tech data and movement data being available for sale, but that kind of data in some ways did somewhat replace what they were getting previously by tapping fiber optics cables. And so it was an evolution of surveillance that happened because of the shift in the ways in which we use technology and the shift in the norms and the sort of governance of these websites and internet architecture. And so I wanted to keep telling the story after Snowden while also grounding it in a moment that readers or listeners, if they're listening to the audiobook, might understand and might remember, in their own minds.
Yeah, that makes sense. When it comes to this new paradigm of ad tech surveillance, I guess you'd call it, there is something called real-time bidding, RTB. You did touch on this at the top about, you know, whenever you download an app with ads in it, it can be part of this. I mean, can you drill down a little bit more, just for people who aren't familiar? Like, how does that work? Like, what is happening behind the scenes when an ad does appear into your app? And like, how does that turn into surveillance?
Sure. It's a mind-numbingly complicated system that took probably you and me like a year or two to fully understand and have some ability to talk about. But essentially, the ways in which display ads are served on websites or in apps is through these instantaneous automatic auctions where thousands of bidders decide and how much they're willing to pay to serve an ad to an open ad space whenever a user opens an app or a website. If you open an app that has, say, geolocation enabled, like a weather app, actually the ad exchange also gets a lot of information back. And that includes the geographical location of the device, because in some instances, advertisers want to serve geographically targeted ads, right? So are you in front of a Burger King? Well, maybe Burger King wants to serve ads to people within, 100 yards of a Burger King in the hopes that they'll be hungry and walk into their store. Makes sense from a marketing perspective. The problem is that on these ad exchanges, thousands of entities are sitting there and only one of them wins the bid. But the thousands of entities that have placed bids are legal participants in the auction can actually see the geographic data that's passed back to the exchange. And it's not just geolocation data. Things like IP address get passed back, things like the mobile ad identifier, even weird esoteric things sometimes get passed back, like what language your keyboard is in, or what direction your gyroscope is pointing, or what level your battery is at. It all depends on how the app is configured and how the ad exchange is configured. And that's tremendously valuable data, right? I mean, you're talking about a window into the cyber activities of billions of devices. I mean, it's no exaggeration to say that every computer or tablet or phone that's connected to the internet is plugged into these exchanges in some way. They may not be giving you a geographical location, but they're giving some data to these exchanges every time they open some ad space or open an app or open a website. And so the fact is that these are open networks designed to bring thousands of minimally vetted parties together, and some of them are in a position to slurp up this data and save it, even if that's not necessarily allowed under the terms of service or it's a gray area. They do it anyway. Some of them are data brokers. Some of them resell it. Some of them are government cutouts. And at the end of the day, it's a tremendously useful way to acquire massive amounts of cyber data on every device in the world.
Yeah, you have either the contractors themselves basically in there, or as you say, sort of these one step removed, these cutouts, which are marketing firms essentially owned by the contractors. You then touch on it in the book as well, in that they're just maybe straight up the intelligence agencies in there in some form as well. Like, you have the contractors, you have their cutouts, you probably have the intel agencies and their cutouts as well. Is that fair?
I think it's fair. I mean, so Google at some point, and it may still, publish the list of entities that were sitting on its OpenX ad exchange, and there are 4,000 of them, right? And to spend the time vetting them is a massive project that maybe journalists and civil society folks should do, but it's a time-consuming project. But I'm sure if you scrub that list, you would find entities that certainly have no real presence and possibly and probably are cutouts for governments or intel agencies or whoever is interested in this data.
Yeah, totally. If anyone listening does come across an interesting one of those, let us know. I'm sure we both appreciate that. Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about something I didn't realize, that was the US government funding of some of these companies and programs as well. We will be right back after this. All right, and we are back. Something I did not realize until I read the book was that the US government wasn't just a client of some of these companies, you know, having the contracts, buying the data or access to the platforms, but in some cases it funded the projects that basically maybe not led to their creation, but, you know, ramped up their expansion. Can you explain a little bit about that dynamic?
Yeah, so it's still a little bit cloaked in mystery, but it's certainly true that, say, the CIA's venture capital arm / nonprofit InQtel made a number of strategic investments in data brokers at various points, or, you know, tools that, took advantage of data. That includes companies that were monitoring the social conversation, and then it also includes companies that were doing things like mapping or trying to understand the movement of devices. In addition, there were other programs that stood up entities or contractors that could acquire data. There were all sorts of experimental funds that sprung up to give money to defense entrepreneurs and intelligence entrepreneurs. And funds flowed through those entities, most of which the public will not have heard of, but, you know, there's some that are sort of household names like DARPA, and then there's some other more obscure ones like CTTSO and a bunch of others. But essentially, governments have been interested in funding interesting and useful technological capabilities for a while, and I found that in a number of instances, these research and development arms of the government were at the forefront of making investments or prodding people to do experiments and funding them as well.
Yeah, totally. Before we move on to the private individual or private company access to this data, sticking with the government contractors for a minute, I mean, there are so many good stories and nuggets in the book that I find it hard to pull one out. So maybe it's just easier to ask you, is there one contractor in there that you think people should pay more attention to or should know more about? Or
well, the one that I think is the most memorable is the story of Xmode, which I think, represents sort of everything I'm writing about in this book, right? So this is a company that was founded on the University of Virginia campus as an app called Drunk Mode. And it was essentially a way to keep undergraduates safe and make sure they didn't do stupid things while they're drinking. So this was a genuinely sort of novelty, somewhat goofy app with a good heart, right? Like intending to try to help people, to keep them safe, to help them avoid embarrassing mistakes. And over the years, the company pivots more into realizing that, hey, actually the location data on our app is more valuable than, you know, trying to sell it for 99 cents or trying to put ad space in it. And then they pivot towards helping other apps who have a similar user base or a similar sort of small business mindset collect that data. So then they become something of a data broker. But over time, they're drawn more and more into the government space. And they always legitimately had commercial clients. They were genuinely selling data in a sort of commercial way, but they increasingly started also taking defense contractors as clients. And at some point, they end up putting this weird signal gathering software into their phone SDK as a mm-hmm. way to collect sort of all the Bluetooth identifiers and the wireless identifiers around devices around the world, and basically turns millions of phones into these Wi-Fi sniffers that are monitoring where various Bluetooth items are around the world. And that was actually a government-linked project as well. And so it's an interesting arc, because you have something that starts out as a rather innocent small business idea by a young college student and morphs into becoming a government contractor because the government hunger for data is so strong and the lure of government money is there. And these companies have difficulty saying no to it in some instances.
Yeah. And listeners may be familiar that Exmos is the company that I found was harvesting data from a Muslim prayer app called Muslim Pro. And then Exmode's clients included US military contractors. And that was a whole thing. And the company, you know, does your book say it was in the middle of the acquisition or something like that?
It was in the middle of its Series B, I believe.
I see. I did not know that while I was reporting.
Your reporting essentially led to Senator Wyden and others on the Hill putting pressure on Apple and Google to cut them off. And Apple and Google cut them off, I believe, either the day before or the week of their Series B closing, and the funding dried up immediately. And so, it was a dramatic moment for the company that both you and I were tangentially involved in.
Yeah, totally. I did not know that. And it's always fun to see extra information about a story that you followed personally. And you're like, oh, holy shit. Okay. The other really interesting thing I found was that you mention private investigators and like private individuals in here. And sort of similar to the dinner scene that it opens with, there's another scene a little bit more towards the end where you find somebody who is willing to rifle through a database of what reads as ad tech data to track specific individual people for $2,500. And you saw this in action, essentially. What happened there?
Yeah, so at some point I wanted to examine the consequences for sort of ordinary people and see how far this had penetrated into a thing you could just do by contacting the right people. And, you know, finding the right people is not as easy as opening up the phone book, but it's not so hard that, you know, you can't do it. And so at some point I was introduced to someone who is a sort of quasi-private investigator, and that person offered me a deal, right? They said $2,500 for a single individual. Just give us their name, their workplace, and any other details you know about them. Or we'll do four people for $9,000. And at the time, I was an exhausted first-time author trying to demonstrate this. So I'm weighing whether to pay, you know, $2,500 to this guy. And, you know, knowing this, I think he ultimately decided to waive it and do a more limited demonstration. So essentially, I asked him to track the CEO of one of these location data companies, because I didn't really want to go deep down the rabbit hole of violating anyone's privacy. But, you know, mm-hmm. if these CEOs are going to broker this data, I did want to see, you know, how much of their own data they were generating. And, mm-hmm. and figure out whether there was any sort of hypocrisy here. And so he was willing to do that in a limited way for me. He identified and told me that the CEO was generating data, but he didn't go any further than giving, he didn't give me a complete report. And then I asked him to run me. And, I had taken some steps to opt myself out of these kind of data brokers and data collection. And I wanted to see if I was in there, and he told me I was not. So that was my encounter with the sort of private eye end of this. I will say that this wasn't sort of a hacker. This was a person who, portrayed themselves as trying to weed out odious use cases and do things that were generally sort of above board and considered, morally in the ballpark. But it just goes to show that this data is out there and available to private entities if they know where to look.
Yeah, and I'm sure a ton of people do know where to look, and that could be, private intelligence firms, anybody who's just trying to track somebody down. I covered how one cybersecurity company was using similar sort of data to track down hackers to their doorstep. And that may be a good use case, but that doesn't mean that everybody's use case is going to be the same, right? You mentioned that you weren't in the data, and that just leads on to my last question. You took some steps to avoid this. The book does have a section on people protecting their own digital privacy. Specifically when it comes to ad tech surveillance, though, what can people do to opt out of that, basically?
Well, it's difficult because any open ad space, as I've said, is going to pass some data back, including potentially your IP address and other ways that your phone is configured. But if you really want to cut down on the leeching of your geographical information, the best thing you can do is be very careful with your permissions, right? Do not allow anything to have 24/7 persistent location. Only enable location when the app is open, when the app is running. Better yet, make it ask. Better yet, don't turn it on at all. Just write the address you're at every time you open Uber. Don't let it have your GPS location. I've also gotten some indication that running a VPN can in some ways break the ad tech chain, especially if you are taking other precautions, like being careful with your settings. Mm-hmm. And just generally speaking, being careful about what apps you put on your phone. Trying to use paid for services whenever possible, and open source ones if you can. And yeah, just generally being pretty smart about your location settings and other settings and your cyber hygiene.
Yes, totally. Right, Byron, thank you for coming on the show, and especially for being the first guest on this experimental interview series. I mean, where can people follow you if they want to keep on top of your work? And I mean, where can they buy the book? I presume anywhere books are sold, right?
Yeah, the book's available anywhere books are sold. It's got a Kindle edition. It's got an audiobook edition. You can follow me on the website formerly known as Twitter at Byron Tau. That's B-Y-R-O-N, last name T as in Tom, A-U. I also write for a brand new nonprofit publication called Notice. That's N-O-T-U-S. I know there's a lot of spelling here, but we're a nonprofit publication covering politics and policy in Washington, and we're at notice.org.
Yeah. All right. Sounds good. I encourage everybody to go check out the book if you even have a passing interest in this stuff. I genuinely learned a lot of new things, and I follow this, obviously, all the time. So with that, I will play us out. As a reminder, 404 Media is journalist-founded and supported by subscribers. If you wish to subscribe to 404 Media and directly support our work, please go to 404media.co. You'll get unlimited access to our articles and an ad-free version of this podcast. You'll also get to listen to the subscribers-only section where we talk about a bonus story each week. Another way to support us is by leaving a 5-star rating and review for the podcast. That stuff really helps us out. This has been 404 Media. We will see you again next week.